right, it's me, and I want to thank everyone at the Oasis Podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis Podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. I hope you guys are all right and keeping cool in the summer sunshine. Today we are going to be catching up on some Oasis news. I did a recording with Richard Bowes a few days ago, just really hearing about his time at Glastonbury because he saw Noel and Paul McCartney and a few other people live. So we caught up on that. We started talking about kind of some of the recent Oasis news, things that had happened, but then I got called away, dog issues, and so we didn't end up recording. So I just thought I'd cover that off here separately myself. And then what I'm also going to do here is if you are interested, then I'm going to drop in the four episodes released so far of my other podcast, which is called Britpop History, where we are reliving the Britpop years exactly 30 years on. So since April, May, June, July, 4 months, we've been looking back to what was going on in 1992, starting in April with Pop Scene by Blur being released, which most people think of as the start of Britpop. So it's a very interesting journey. They're kind of mini episodes, about 10, 12 minutes each. So we're going to drop those in. So if you're not interested in that, that's fine. You can bail after my chat with Richard. But if you'd like to listen to that, then you can hear all four in one go. And if you want to hear the future ones, then just check out the Oasis Podcast B-Sides feed. And they will be dropping in monthly as long as I keep doing it. I'll also might end up doing some more stuff and use that Oasis Podcast B-Sides as well. But we shall see. Anyway, let's go over now to my conversation with Richard about Glastonbury that ends quite abruptly. And then I will be back in a minute and we'll cover off some important issues in the world of Oasis from the last couple of weeks. Cool. All right. Welcome back to the Oasis Podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. I'm joined by my regular contributor, conspirator, Richard Bowes. How are you doing, Richard?
Morning, JC. I'm all right, mate. I'm all right. Thank you. A bit warm already as this heat wave approaches. But, Boris Johnson resigned. So, it's not bad in the world.
Yeah, that was pretty nuts. I mean, obviously this isn't a politics podcast, but we don't tend to go into politics or anything, but yeah, I hated that guy, so I was very pleased to see him go. But yes, very happy about that. Are you on your Glastonbury? Have you got over Glastonbury yet? Are you still on your Glastonbury come down?
Yes, I'm still. I mean, similarly, this Boris Johnson thing is really even eating into my iPlayer time. It's quite frustrating, really. Because I'm weird. I basically there's the festival process, and then you have to, let's say, go back and rewatch everything on the iPlayer and stuff. So I'm still kind of in that zone. I finished off McCartney's set last night, so I'm still in the haze of it. But it's dwindling. It's a couple of weeks on, it's dwindling. But it was incredible. Like the whole festival was incredible. Couldn't really have got any better weather-wise. There's a bit of kind of drizzle on Friday, but you actually want that because you don't want it to be too hot, because walking around in 30 degree heat on a site that's got a perimeter fence of 9 miles, you get your steps in, so you don't really want to walk around in the heat. So yeah, couldn't really complain about that. And yeah, it was well worth a 3-year wait, I would say.
Yeah, fair enough. And you did it, you were like volunteering, weren't you, to get to... Yeah, partly because you're obviously such a good person with great moral backbone, but also to blag the free tickets.
Absolutely, yeah. I entirely believe in water rates principles, who I volunteered with. But yeah, basically because I couldn't get a ticket in 2019. And also, I mean, I would have done volunteered anyway. But then once I kind of realised it was Paul McCartney and Noel, who, you know, Noel having, I mean, I've been going to Glastonbury for like 15 years, but obviously in that time, Noel's never played. So it's kind of always been a bit of an ambition or a tick box to see him there. So yeah, I volunteered with WaterAid. I ended up spending 10 days down at the farm. So I was down there on the Tuesday before the festival, and I was there until the Thursday afterwards, doing the part of the cleanup team. So I got a free ticket for the festival, didn't miss anything out, wasn't working, but yeah, it was part of the cleanup team afterwards. So it was, which was pretty hard graft, to be honest. So yeah, I fully lived the Glastonbury experience, all 10 days of it, rather than 5 days for normal people.
So with the cleanup, are you literally going around picking up everyone's crap afterwards?
Not exactly. So we were part of, like, our team was like bulking, so it was like cleaning up the tents and cleaning up like people's bin bags they haven't kind of tied up, and like air beds and that sort of stuff. So I mean, because the site's so big, even in 3 days we did like half the site, just because right. Yeah, it's too big. So just yeah, it's effectively taking out tents and putting them down for people to in the recycling area, or for them to be recycled, was effectively in a nutshell what it was. But you know, as I say, it was like 3 full days of like from 8:30 till 4:30 kind of doing that. So it was quite physically quite hard graft. And got to say, the spiritual and emotional come down of Glastonbury on the Monday, when, you know, when my wife had gone, all my friends had gone, and I still had another 3 days and I've not started work yet, it probably made it one of the worst days of my life, to be honest. But, you know, in contrast to a great 5 days previously. So, you know.
Yeah, I know that because obviously, you know, I'm not too far from Reading, and you go past, you know, from being an ex-Reading resident, you go past the Reading Festival site on the train when you're going west out of Reading. And yeah, and it's nuts when you go and you just see like the aftermath of just thousands of people just fuck it, I can't be asked my tent, I'll just leave it. Like, seriously, just leaving your tent, that's just nuts. But yeah, thousands of people do.
Yeah, it's not actually that bad. It's a lot better than it used to be, from what I can understand. It's a lot better than it used to be. I think Emily Eva said in 2019, like 93% of people took their tents. And I think because they've got a whole kind of love the farm, leave no trace ethos, which they really push, a lot of people buy into it and do kind of pack up stuff. Obviously, a lot of people don't. And, you know, some of the, I mean, you could tell by the people who left, sorry, by the tents that had been left behind, what sort of people they were. Do you know what I mean? They were, well, in saying that, there were some areas like they were very, very, you know, brand new tents. Some people like saying there's like a tent was worth of like £1,000. People just left it behind, you know, and there were cascaded bottles of Bollinger, and you're like, okay, so it's not entirely for the party animals. It's also been entitled upper classes. So, but yeah, it's generally quite good. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to do it 10 years ago, for example. Right. But it wasn't too bad. As I say, we were only in 3 days, we managed to do half the site, and I presume there was another team doing the other half of the site. Just because it's such a big site, you could probably cover Reading in a day, you know, for example, because Reading is actually quite small. But yeah, just because Glastonbury's so big, just so much of it. But it was good for the soul.
And going on to the music, then I suppose that's the main thing that's important there. What was your highlights? Is it Noel and Macca, obviously, or is there anything else that jumps above that?
I mean, yeah, it's hard to really look beyond those two. I mean, the thing is, I mean, Noel was good. It was, I mean, I think you've kind of mentioned it on Twitter before, and it has been pointed out, you know, the set does need freshening up.
Yeah.
I think it was largely this, I mean, obviously the sequencing was different, but the set, the songs involved were largely the same, apart from, you know, We're On Our Way Now, to that of 3 years ago. Yeah, he said recently, didn't he, that he's cracked how to do it. You know, first half High Flying Bird, second half Oasis, especially for a festival. You know, you can't go wrong with that. I mean, as an avid fan, loved the whole thing. You know, loved, I was quite far down into it, and you know, was loving all the High Flying Bird stuff. And the atmosphere did certainly kick off when you know made that transition from Little by Little onwards, and you know. Wonderwall, I couldn't see because it was just everyone's hands in the air and cameras up in the air, phones up in the air. Likewise, Don't Look Back in Anger. So yeah, it was a solid set from Noel, I would say, and very good. But yeah, it was a festival set, but yeah, I think his set does need freshening up, and I think the new material next year. I mean, it would have been nice to have had some newer. Yeah, like I know he's mentioned he's doing Falling Down next year, but you know, some like Oasis ones that he hadn't put in the set, but he did say like they didn't have time to rehearse any new old songs. But it was good. I mean, yeah, I mean, 100,000 people in the field singing, you know, with national anthems like Wonderwall, Don't Black and Anger. You know, whatever, for me, was quite a highlight just because I love that one so much. Black Star Dancing sounded great in the field as it did at Heaton Park. Dead in the Water was a Glastonbury moment. That was quite spellbinding, really, as it is live, you know, similar at Heaton Park when I saw him. It was, you know, just him and his guitar, and sometimes there's nothing quite like that. But in terms of actual highlights, yeah, it's hard to look beyond Macca, really. You know, 3-hour set. You know, as an ardent Beatles fan, or Macca fan indeed, like 3-hour set was amazing. I was a little bit annoyed, to be honest, that when Bruce Springsteen came on, that they did Glory Days. So I was like, well, it's kind of eating into Macca's set, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. There's enough Beatles songs and Paul McCartney solo songs. There's no need to be doing Bruce Springsteen songs. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just thought, well, it just must be fun for him. You know what I mean? To get to do that.
Yeah, and it kind of brought back flashbacks of Springsteen's 2009 Pyramid set, which went on for about 3 hours, but as not really a Springsteen fan, it was just like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, here's another mid-paced song they've really heard of. Do you know what I mean? It was kind of like that was what flashbacks to that. But it was, you know, it was a nice kind of thing for the event. And obviously, you know, there was the people were saying Macca's voice wasn't great. I think, you know, it was weak. It was undeniably weak.
Yeah.
As you expect from an 80-year-old man. But it didn't stop him trying. Do you know what I mean? It didn't have the power it did. I think he was still hitting the notes.
Yeah.
Not quite as strong as once he did.
It's always, it's difficult, isn't it? Because I don't think people talk about this enough, but he's a soul singer. You know, he's big inspiration was Little Richard. And that's what he does. He does all that warbling kind of soul voice singing. And so, you know, how do you do that when you're 80 years old and your voice is cracked from, you know, years of smoking as well, the good weed and things, you know, of course it's going to be cracked, you know, it's 3 hours. Are you serious? You know, and these songs, he doesn't, I don't know if he moves the key either. So, you know, he's going for it. And I agree. I partly think, you know, look at sort of the later years of Johnny Cash, you know, his American recordings, you know, he knew the voice is gone. Like, I know he was never doing like, you know, Little Richard style histrionics anyway, but he kind of knew to adapt his voice to what it became. And I think, you know, I mean, stuff like, I love that tune he did. I was really pleased he did it. My Valentine. That's probably one of my favorite songs he's done in the last sort of 15 years. And so it's lovely to hear that. And I think that's a perfect thing that he could be doing. He could be doing like, you know, the American Songbook kind of stuff now, like Rod Stewart and Brian Ferry have done, which I generally think is a bit of a cheesy, obvious way to go. But actually, for Macca's voice right now, I think that would be perfect.
What if it rained? We didn't care. She said that someday soon the sun was gonna shine. And she was right. This love of mine, my Valentine.
Yeah, but by the same token, when you see Macca, you want Macca, don't you? So it's like, you know, I agree with that in terms of like from his voice point of view. But you know, give me Live and Let Die over, you know, give me Live and Let Die over everything. And you know, I think there was the combination of his recent 80th. You know, it was really sad actually, because you look and go, oh God, he's proper old now. you know. Mm. And that sounds ridiculous. He's still far better Nick than any 80-year-old person you're ever going to see is. Mm. But you kind of look at him, and he's kind of got that, I don't know, still just a little bit. His mobility was a little bit less, you know, a little bit restrained, as one would expect from 81. But it's, you know, Paul McCartney, I'm sure I speak for both of us, and indeed most a lot of people on podcasts, he's speaking personally, one of the most familiar male figures of my life. You know what I mean? Yeah, the first record I ever had was the Fog Song. Yeah, you know, and as a 3-year-old or whatever, and now, you know, it's still there. He's, you know, it's an obvious comparison, I guess, but like the Queen, you know what I mean? Just one of those very familiar figures throughout your life, and just to see him get that, just that tipping into the proper old man kind of age, like it was very bittersweet. I think it's also not to be morbid, it's kind of like, well, how many more times are you going to see him do that?
I mean, you never know, he might be there at 96, you know what I mean? He's so bloody impressive. But yeah, like, it was the one that got me was when he walked back from, well, when the platform raised and he did the acoustic songs up on the platform, I was shitting myself. I was like, what are you doing? He shouldn't be up there. Is he insured? Like, you know, is there rails? Like, you know, he's an 80-year-old man. Don't be, and the most national treasure, don't be lifting him up 50 feet in the air. And then thankfully he was, you know, he didn't fall off. He came back down. And as he wandered then back to the main stage, I mean, that's quite a trek. And he did it holding his guitar up in the air. I thought, bloody hell, I could hardly hold a guitar up in the air over my head. And I'm, you know, almost 40 years younger than he is. So, but it's, I was just absolutely blown away by him, really. But yeah, as I said, the voice is weak. I'm not going to go back and listen to that on audio. I think on audio, that would be a pretty... Yeah, not a pleasant experience, but yeah, just to be in the, you know, in there with the guy.
Yeah, just the weight of history, you know, you think about all the people he's lost, you know, obviously John Lennon, George Martin, George Harrison, Mal Evans, Linda, you know, it's obviously, you know, Ringo's still alive, but it's kind of like, it does very much have the kind of, you know, the last man standing kind of vibe. Yeah. Just the weight, I say, just the history that he carries and the people that have been with him along the way that aren't here anymore. It's just, it was impossible not to be moved by that, put it that way. And I guess also kind of atmosphere of like 3 years away, you know, better to re-bring the party as well than, you know, the greatest, say, greatest British songwriter of all time.
The one that really got me was Something, when he had the images of George on the screen. That was like really, really powerful, I thought. Stick around and it may show.
So I was just going to say a few other ones as well, like Jack White, who did a secret set, was...
Oh, yeah, with his blue hair.
Yeah, he was incredible. Like, we had quite a good spot for that. And I mean, I've never properly seen him live. I've seen the Raconteurs and the Dead Weather from a distance, but I've never kind of seen him solo. Well, I've certainly never seen him solo. And I've never seen him up close. I mean, phenomenal, like, mind-blowingly good. Yeah. Like, proper, like, face-meltingly, you know. If you're a rock fan, just seeing Jack White, you know, one of the great guitarists, go nuts, was unreal. Supergrass, you know, were brilliant. Did exactly what you'd expect, but we love it. Yard Act were quite good, although I don't know, really think the tent kind of suits them. I think they're better at a kind of smaller venue, but it was quite interesting to see them learning as they go along. Who else did we watch? Jarvis, which bit of a letdown, actually. Jarvis, I think he kind of misjudged it and played a lot of new stuff.
Yeah.
Like, by that I don't mean new stuff, I mean new songs that haven't been released yet. Not even
stuff
from beyond the last album, which was, after Jack White, I think that was a bit of a misstep. I mean, fortunately, you're always entertained with Jarvis, but that was a bit of a curious one. Pet Shop Boys were unbelievable.
Like, oh, yeah.
And again, like, I mean, when I was a child, I was really into the Pet Shop, well, younger, I was really into the Pet Shop Boys, but I'm not really properly followed them for like 30 years. But I think there were two songs I didn't know. Do you know what I mean? It was a proper like greatest hit set. And you know, similar with Supergrass, kind of like as a singles band, they're up there
fearless.
With
anyone. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's like probably having never seen them before, it's like band you thought, well, I wouldn't pay to go and see you, but at a festival, bring it on. And
brilliant.
They were amazing. Yeah, there was no one really underwhelming apart from probably the Libertines, who were a bit one word you wouldn't have chosen with the Libertines 20 years ago. They were competent. But it's, I don't know, they're a heritage band now, which is a kind of concept I really struggle with.
They were so young and dangerous, weren't they, when they came out. I always remember their Jules Holland performance. They're doing Boys in the Band. And there's a couple of their, like, you know, obviously they're girl hangers on from the scene. They're sort of dancing around, and it reminds me of like when the Sex Pistols had like Susie Sue and people like that in the background. It was like, yeah, this is the new gang, this is the cool gang that you want to be a part of. And they're just not the cool gang anymore. They're just, you know,
they're just, it was like something, I guess, seeing them at 11 o'clock in the morning. It was, I kind of had a similar thing when BDI played the same slot, actually, 2013, like at the opening of the other stage at 11 o'clock in the morning, and it just wasn't right. There was something horrible about seeing like Morning Glory and Rock and Roll Star, you know, get a very muted response at that time of day. And there was a similar thing with the Libertines, but it was just like, oh, Compton. It's also like, right, are you going to do a fourth album? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, your last album was 7 years ago, I think it was. You know, you can't really say they've got a greatest hit set per se. They've been trotting out the same set for quite a few years now, and it was just a little bit
I saw someone say, I think it might have been Andy Middleton on our Discord chat, saying about, you know, it was awful that they were so low down on the bill and they weren't on on TV. I don't know if you can even see their stuff on iPlayer, because they were but then I thought, I can kind of understand it. I saw them a few years ago at Truck Festival, and it was like, you know, yeah, the first year that a big band comes back, it's really exciting because they're back and you really want to see them. Or if they're doing like a specific anniversary of an album or something like that, it's like, oh yeah. But then when it's just like, oh, it's another tour because probably Pete needs the money, you know, it's like, well, yeah, it's not like the special, oh, Libertines, well, yeah, they were there a couple of years ago, you know what I mean? It's sort of, so I kind of get that. And if you love the Libertines, yes, absolutely. But yeah, I just was a bit like, yeah, okay. It's, you know, I wasn't desperate to dig them out and watch it.
I mean, yeah, I agree. I mean, to be fair, that slot is, it's not a first on the bill slot. It's an opening slot. So like the fact, BDI have done it for Kaiser Chiefs, James, I think, have done it. You know, it's not like, first on
the lowest on the bill,
exactly. It's one of the big things to open up the festival with, because the, you know, Glastonbury kind of plays with slots a bit, so it wasn't that, you know, they weren't low personally, but yeah, it was it's a bit stale, which is ironic. You wouldn't have seen that, you know, a few years ago. There was all the excitement about their reunion, and now it's like,
On again. Yeah, fair enough. Good, cool, all right. And so you chose to watch Paul McCartney. You didn't choose to go and watch Jamie T from a disabled viewing area?
No, I didn't, no. I mean, yeah, because I love Jamie T. I've seen him quite a few times. I've seen Macca a few times. But, yeah, the choice is McCartney or Jamie T. I've always been choosing Macca. So, yeah, I steered well away from any of that.
We'll be right back.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Richard. Very jealous, would have loved to have got to Glastonbury, but there you go. Could I really be bothered to be sort of clearing up after people for 3 days to get tickets? It's Paul McCartney. I don't know. We shall see. Right, let's just cover off some bits, shall we? So probably the first thing that happened that I thought was quite interesting was Liam Gallagher got paid reportedly £500,000 to play a show for the owner of B&M. Fair enough, I'd say. If he's willing to pay it and he's willing to do it, why the hell not? 500 grand, that is not too bad. If I had 500 grand, I would get Liam to come and play at my birthday party. So no issues with that at all. I hope a pleasant time was had by all. In other news, Liam ended up having to close a show early. This was at the Beauregard Festival, and he walked off after just 4 songs. So let's check this out. So, yeah, so as I say, he walked off there. He did tweet the next day, which felt very much like a company tweet rather than Liam, something he would have said himself. I mean, the spelling is significantly better than Liam would normally do. So it was, apologies to everyone who came out to Festival Beauregard last night. I was so disappointed to have to cut the set short. I've been diagnosed today with laryngitis and I'm on doctor's orders to get some rest. Unfortunately, that means I have to cancel my upcoming show in Cognac. I never want to let anyone down. I'm really sorry for any disappointment, but I have to put my health first, LG. So there you go. Liam's not cancelled a show for a while, actually, or walked out on a show. But there you go. He couldn't finish that one. So a bit gutted for the people that were there and gutted for the people that had got tickets for the Cognac show. But there you go. Yes, so that's Liam doing Liam things with his laryngitis. Let's hope he gets better and carries on okay for the rest of the tour. The other thing, I suppose, is that Be Here Now is getting a 25th anniversary re-release, and it's a silver vinyl and not much else, a cassette and a t-shirt. So no new tracks, no live album, nothing really. I mean, we'll see whether anything else happens, like Noel did the, you know, Back to Rockfield for Morning Glory and things like that. You know, maybe if something else might come up, you never know. But right now, all they've announced is a vinyl, which, as I said, I'm not a big vinyl collector. So, yeah, doesn't interest me at all. But those of you that are vinyl heads, I'm sure you'll enjoy it. But, yeah, not bothered whatsoever. I would much rather, you know, a release of the G-Mex show or a release of kind of, you know, a compilation of the best performances on the Be Here Now tour, or, you know, or a video, a documentary about the Be Here Now tour, or, you know, Be Here Now era. You know, there's loads that you could do, but no, we don't get anything. We get a silver vinyl. So there you are. And finally, I won't put it off, but let's talk about this. Noel Gallagher got into a bit of bother after Glastonbury. So let's just pick up on kind of what's happened. On either the Saturday night or the Sunday morning, I can't remember, I saw a couple of tweets flying around sort of saying, it wasn't a first person tweet, but someone had said, oh, it's awful that Noel Gallagher, Rita Ora and their mates had sort of to come onto the disabled viewing platform, and this person wasn't too happy about it. Then a bunch of people, obviously, this is Twitter, there's always going to be a pile on, a bunch of people jumped on and saying how dreadful that was. And then we didn't really hear much more about it until Noel was interviewed on the Matt Morgan podcast, and he said this.
And Jamie T was just starting, and they wanted to go and see Jamie T, so I took them, we went on a and mission all the way up through the fields to the John Peel tent to see Jamie T. It was brilliant. We blagged it on the disabled platform.
I've heard that someone's actually, there's a question about this. Where is it?
All right.
Someone said,
this guy come up and said, can I see your pass, please? So I showed him Max's all areas pass. And he said, you know, this is a disabled platform. And I was like, so that's what all the disability scooters are for. that's weird. And he said, he's supposed to be up there. And I was like, see that pass, mate? That gets me any fucking where.
Yeah.
Anywhere. Okay.
It's not like you tipped someone out of a wheelchair to sit there, right? Or did you?
If I had to, I would have. I said to Sonny, get in that wheelchair.
Come on, Sonny. I mean, yeah.
What was the question?
Rob Bryant said, now, I don't want to get Nanny in trouble again so soon after the Margate yawn, but can you ask Nolo about him, Rita Ora, and their mates taking over the disabled viewing platform in the John Peel tent?
I'd say we took it over. We did shuffle on there, though.
I bet you're up there, absolutely bad. Come on, fucking try and walk. Have you ever really tried? Come on. It's Jamie T, man.
Touching people on the forehead and saying, rise, you can walk.
Punching them in the legs. You can feel that, right? Come on. Who is Jamie T, anyway? I don't know.
He's a Cockney geezer, isn't he? He's like a little street lad. He's a good lad, actually. I know him. And it's my 11-year-old is, you know, starting on his journey of playing guitar, and I was like, look, let's go see Jamie T. And Rita, who's a very dear friend of mine, she knows all that lot. And then there was a few of us went up there, and then we got to the bit, we couldn't get to the bit where you get onto the stage because we were fucking all drunk and fucking wasted. And it was like, right, how do we get there? And I just said, look, fuck it, we'll go through the front. And then, you know, flashed my pass and just said, all these lot are with me. And that was it. And we walked on this platform. Unbeknownst to us, it was the disabled platform. And I got to say, those disabled cats, they've got a great view of everything.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, there's downsides.
So, yes, the thing to remember with Noel and Matt's podcast is they are not a typical interview. You know, this is like two mates having a chat, having a laugh. This is banter. This is sort of, you know, this is pretty tame, to be honest, compared to a lot of the stuff they've said in the podcast. But anyway, this got picked up. You know, someone at the Daily Mirror obviously pays their £5 a month to Matt Morgan because he's then picked this up. He's then asked Scope, the charity, for a comment, and Scope has laid into them for his sort of his actions, and then also his words about disabled people. And then there's another Twitter pile on and everyone's having a go at Noel. So what do we think about this? Well, I would love to actually hear from someone who was there. Because, yes, if he had literally charged onto a viewing platform, there wasn't enough space for the disabled people. He was upsetting people. He was in the way. That is absolutely dreadful. And it's inexcusable behaviour. You shouldn't do it. However, is that really the case? You know, if that wasn't the case, and if actually there was lots of space and the people on that platform were quite happy about having celebrities on there and like, wow, how great, how exciting to get to watch a gig with Noel Gallagher or Rita Ora, you know, if you're more of a pop music fan, that'd be amazing. So, you know, we don't know unless we hear from someone that, you know, was there and could say, oh yeah, they barged in, they got in the way, it was dreadful. Then yeah, absolutely, that's wrong. I mean, generally, obviously, it's wrong to be taking up space on a disabled viewing platform. But, you know, let's, before everyone gets too excited about the Twitter pile-on, why don't we just see if we can hear from someone who was actually there and what actually really happened. Then you get Noel's comments. It's rude. It's you know, I can understand why people are upset about that. You know, the sort of their jokes, you know, but I get it. You can, if you're triggered by that sort of thing, then yes, it's not pleasant to be triggered by jokes that are going to upset you. However, they're jokes, you know, that's what comedy's about. And as I said, he wouldn't say that on BBC Breakfast. You know, this is sort of him talking to his mate, which is a very niche podcast, only listened to by, you know, a couple of thousand people probably that download Matt's podcast. So, you know, yes, were his comments
insensitive and rude. Yes, they were. But it's kind of to be expected. This is what Noel does. He's not going to apologise. He's probably laughing his head off that it ended up getting in a newspaper and it ended up causing a big stir online because, you know, that's what he does. Like a few months ago when he called Prince Harry a snowflake, you know, that's kind of, that's what he does. He's always wound people up, you know, wishing people died of AIDS or all kinds of stuff he said over the years. So actually, this is probably not in the top 10 of outrageous stuff that Noel has said. Does it make it right? No. And as I said, if people were upset about that, they have every right to be upset about it. But that's comedy. People are always going to get upset. So there we go. I think I've sort of successfully tiptoed around that one. All right, I think that will do it for the news and the chat. Oh, the only other thing to say is actually Matt Morgan has now removed all of the Noel Gallagher podcasts from his feed. So, yes, I think he said something along the lines of, let's wait until this all dies down, because obviously what you probably end up having is journalists then scouring through to find any other sort of outrageous stuff they've said over the years. And like I said, they've said a lot of outrageous stuff. Fingering dogs' arseholes is one of the things that they regularly come back to. So, you know, there's some pretty outrageous stuff in there. He's taken them down for now, which is a shame because that's kind of why I've pay my £5 a month to Matt Morgan. We shall wait to see if they sort of come back once the clamour has died down. But and I hope Matt's okay. I think Matt can get, while I said Noel's not bothered about this, he probably finds it hilarious. Actually, Matt Morgan is, you know, he does seem like quite a sensitive soul. So I hope he's all right in all this. Anyway, there we go. That's all I've got to say about that. Let's now cross over to Britpop history. So we're going to start off with April 1992, and we're going to just play through the four Britpop history episodes that have been released so far. And if you would like to hear more, then go and subscribe to the Oasis Podcast B-Sides channel, and where you will hear more. I'll see you on the other side. Yes, in the real world, it is April 2022, and it's not a particularly fun place to be. However, here on Britpop History, we are reliving the musical and cultural movement known as Britpop exactly 30 years on. So, where do you start with Britpop? Musical movements don't tend to start with one defining, tidy moment. But for this, our first episode, we are taking the jumping-off point as the chart entry of the song that many people feel is the first Britpop single, Pop Scene by Blur. So what's happening here in April 1992? In the UK, John Major's Conservatives have just won a general election that many had predicted they were going to lose. In the USA, President George H.W. Bush is midway through what would be his only term as president. And in Europe, Serbian troops are sieging the Bosnian capital, Sarajevo. In UK cinemas, the Robert De Niro psychological thriller Cape Fear and Steven Spielberg's revisionist take on the Peter Pan story Hook both topped the box office in April. Also on 12th of April, Euro Disney opens in Paris, and on 20th of April, the Freddie Mercury tribute concert takes place at Wembley Stadium with performances from Elton John, George Michael, Lisa Stansfield, Guns N' Roses and Metallica. The UK music scene at the time was in a similar place to how it had been for much of the late 1980s, with indie bands being truly indie, so even the more successful ones such as Ride, Carter USM and In Spiral Carpets were very much separate from the mainstream acts dominating the charts like Wet Wet Wet, Right Said Fred and Annie Lennox. Much historical looking back at the birth of Britpop and how this all changed tends to focus on the offices of PR firm Savage and Best and the Good Mixer pub in Camden, with the growth of Suede and Elastica. However, it shouldn't be overlooked that all around the country there were plenty of other new bands forming, or existing bands who had had some success already, developing their sound into something less groove-based or traditionally indie and into a more accessible style focused around classic songwriting that would later be defined as Britpop. Blur certainly fit that mould.
having had already enjoyed success with their debut album Leisure, even getting to number 8 in the singles charts with There's No Other Way 1 year before. However, that album was still very much in the throes of the baggy scene, which had been dominant for the previous few years. Released on 30th of March 1992, Pop Scene feels like the first Britpop single. Stereo guitar fuzz effects give way to rampant drums, driving bass and bombastic horns before Damon starts ranting the lyrics in his own, albeit slightly affected, English accent at about 100 miles an hour before that incredibly catchy stop-start chorus dripping with irony, "Hey, hey, come out tonight, Pop Scene, all right." Damon seems to be drawing attention to and commenting on the Britpop scene before it's even started. The song is bursting with energy and stands up as one of the finest songs of the era, although it was met with pretty awful reviews at the time, and 32 on the UK singles chart was well below what they were hoping as a band that had previously made the top 10. Also on the charts, week commencing 5th of April 1992, were a number of songs from other bands that had already been around, but would go on to be important in the Britpop scene, and looking at these tells the story of where British indie music was at that time. James' Ring the Bells was at number 54, having reached a peak of 37, the third single from their fourth album, Seven. Whereas other bands that had success in the early 90s like Blur and The Charlatans were able to become part of the Britpop scene, James never really did in the peak years of 1994 to 1996, with their releases in that period being the more experimental album Wah Wah in 1994, and then lead singer Tim Booth going off to do the Booth and the Bad Angel project with film composer Angelo Badalamenti, released in 1996. It was only in 1997 with their album Whiplash and lead single She's a Star that they would be swept along with the Britpop wave, making the UK singles top 10 for the first time since 1991. Lightning Seeds were at 46, with The Life of Riley having fallen from the high point of 28. This was the first single from their second album, Sense, and having come out a few weeks before Pop Scene, one could argue that this was the first Britpop single. It similarly had an upbeat attitude, vocals sang in a regional accent, and driving horns. It would also go on to have much more of a longer life and far greater exposure, given it was used as the Goal of the Month theme on Match of the Day throughout much of the 90s. Although Ian Brody, having been an experienced performer and producer on the Liverpool scene for many years, meant that Lightning Seeds felt more like a continuation of that, rather than as part of the more fashionable London-centric wave of bands. Manic Street Preachers' Slash and Burn was at 39, having just sneaked into the top 20 a couple of weeks before. While they would go on to release some of the defining songs and albums of the era, this, the fourth single from their debut album Generation Terrorists, owed much more of a debt to the American hair metal of the previous decade. Fuck it! Finally, it's very interesting to see that one place below Pop Scene on that week's chart was another new entry, The Stone Roses' I Am the Resurrection, at 33. This was the last song released from their self-titled debut album, with label Silvertone wringing every last drop from it, as at this point they were very much estranged from the band, having gone through various legal wrangles. We wouldn't hear anything new from the Roses until November 1994, by which time everything on the indie scene had changed dramatically. But that is all to come. Meanwhile, in Manchester, former In Spiral Carpets roadie Noel Gallagher had joined his brother's fledgling band Oasis the previous year. They spent much of the last few months honing their sound, rehearsing and playing at the Boardwalk in Manchester, and April 1992 saw them play their first gig out of Manchester at the North West Kent College of Technology in Dartford on the 19th. The next night they were back up north in Oldham at the Hippodrome, supporting Peter Hook from New Order's new band Revenge. The following months would see them continue to rehearse relentlessly and gig occasionally until everything changed for them on May 31st, 1993. We'll get there. Another Manchester band from the baggy scene, The Charlatans, had recently released their second album between 10th and 11th on the 23rd of March, with lead single Weirdo coming out a couple of weeks prior. Driven by swirling Hammond and with Tim Burgess' laconic Mancunian drawl, this can certainly be seen as a bridge from the more baggy and shoegaze feel of their debut Some Friendly to the more classic songwriting influenced work to come. Most of the time you are happy, you're a weirdo. And before the introduction ends, some will feel sorry for themselves. In Liverpool, The La's classic debut album had been released in October 1990, and with singles such as There She Goes and Timeless Melody, they had eschewed the baggy sound and had much more centred on a Beatles-based classic songwriting. By December 1991, however, bassist John Power had become frustrated with Lee Mavers' unpredictability and left the band. He would switch to guitar and started putting a new band together, which would be called Cast, or Cast, and would start gigging later in 1992. Birmingham-based band Ocean Colour Scene had released their self-titled debut album the previous month, although it did not sell well and was poorly received, with them in conflict with the label Fontana, pushing them into a more of a baggy shoegaze sound. This poor performance would ultimately see them in dispute with the label and back on the dole. Meanwhile, ex-Jam and Style Council singer and guitarist Paul Weller released his debut solo album in April 1992, although only in Japan. UK fans would need to wait for lead single Uh-huh, Oh Yeah in August and then the album in September. Weller would then recruit Steve and Damon from Ocean Colour Scene into his touring band the next year, giving them the financial security to keep going, and Ocean Colour Scene would be back with a classic second album later in the decade. Heading back to the Camden scene, Justine Frischmann had split from Suede the previous year, and the remaining members continued to gig in and around London, securing a record deal with Nude Records in February. On 25th of April, the band were featured on the cover of Melody Maker, being heralded as the best new band in Britain. This before their debut single, The Drowners, had even been released. Meanwhile, Justine would start to put what would become Elastica together with ex-Suede drummer Justin Welch later that year. So that's where we leave things in April 1992. Join us next time as we continue to relive Britpop 30 years on. For now, I just want to thank you very much for listening. Feel free to follow at Britpop History on Twitter. And we will see you next time. Hey, hey, come out tonight. Hey, hey, come out tonight. Party! We'll be right back. Hello and welcome back to Britpop History, the podcast where we are reliving the Britpop years in real time, exactly 30 years on. Welcome to May 1992. In the news, in Los Angeles, there's widespread rioting following the acquittal of four white police officers for beating Rodney King. And in the UK, plans are unveiled for a fifth terminal at Heathrow Airport. Also, UEFA have just announced that the 1996 European Football Championships will be held in England. The major Britpop milestone we are discussing today is the release of the debut single from Suede, The Drowners. Written by Brett Anderson and Bernard Butler, it was released on 11th of May 1992, and while it only reached 49 in the UK singles chart, it got great reviews and the band were already being heralded as the most exciting new group in the country. The song itself is remarkable, a glam rock anthem with Anderson's sexually ambiguous lyrics and distinctive phrasing, while Butler's guitar complements perfectly, letting loose, writhing and soaring. Listening to this alongside everything else coming out around the time in 1992, it jumps out as being a callback to the more discerning moments of 70s glam rock, plus pushes forward to something new and unique. Meanwhile, the proliferation of rave music into the mainstream was clear, with Nottingham dance act KWS holding the number one spot throughout May. Their record was a double A-side, with the main song being the dance pop hit Please Don't Go. But then the other track, the far less heard Game Boy, is a pure blast of rave energy. Other rave tunes hitting the charts in May were the subtly named Raving I'm Raving by Shut Up and Dance and the classic On a Ragga Tip by SL2. Meanwhile, there were a number of indie tunes in the charts which helped to tell us the story of the indie scene from which Britpop emerged. Morrissey was back with the lead single from his upcoming album, Your Arsenal. We hate it when our friends become successful. The Smiths and Morrissey were a huge influence on early Suede as well as a number of other Britpop bands, and this track in particular, with its ironic laugh throughout the chorus, taps into that same wry humour that would become a big part of the Britpop scene. Oh,
Many of the key players in the indie scene of the late 80s and 90s were represented in May. The biggest indie hit of the period was Carter USM's Only Living Boy in New Cross. Having been released in April, it peaked in May at number 7. The 12-minute, 53-second epic Weekender by Flowered Up hit the charts in May, as did Feel by former Creation Records' House of Love, current Creation Records' Swerve Driver with Never Lose That Feeling, and Liverpool band The Real People had their biggest hit, reaching 38 with Believer. If you listen to the Oasis podcast, you will know that The Real People are hugely important in the Oasis story. And in 1993, they would go on to help Oasis to hone their sound, recording the live demonstration tape. They were also an inspiration to Oasis via the fact that Noel Gallagher shamelessly ripped off a number of their songs. And listening back to this one, there's a definite similarity in the verse melody to the Oasis song Fade Away. Check it out. I'm a believer and I Speaking of Fade Away, Oasis played their 7th gig on the 5th of May, with Fade Away getting its first play. The set for the show with the Yah-Yahs in Oldham was still primarily based on tracks that would not end up getting official releases, with the only exceptions being Columbia and the aforementioned Fade Away. The charts in May also featured Come Play With Me by The Wedding Present, St Etienne, Join Our Club, People Get Real, the 15 Years EP from The Levellers, Eat Yourself Whole by Kingmaker, Two Worlds Collide by In Spiral Carpets with a certain roadie, and Rich and Strange by Cud, a song I always find hilarious as a friend of mine is called Richard Strange. He actually owns a record shop and was featured on episode 4 of the Oasis podcast if you want to give that a listen. Anyway, that's where we'll end it here in episode 2 of Britpop History. Join us next time to look back at June 1992 as longtime Sheffield hopefuls Pulp have another crack at chart success. Will their new single, Oh You Gone Gone, be the track to finally break them through to the mainstream? Plus, the Manics release the 5th single from their debut album. Now, by the time you get to a 5th single from an album, surely you're scraping the barrel? Not so much in this case. See you next time. Hello and welcome back to Britpop History, the podcast where we are reliving the Britpop years in real time, exactly 30 years on. Welcome to June of 1992. In the news, Michael Jordan wins his 2nd NBA championship and his 2nd Finals MVP as his Chicago Bulls beat the Portland Trail Blazers in 6 games. US Vice President Dan Quayle incorrectly spells the word potato with an E, And in Hollywood, Batman Returns opens, featuring Danny DeVito as Penguin, Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman, and Michael Keaton returning as the Caped Crusader.
From the rooftops of Gotham, the perfect enemy comes to life.
I am Catwoman. Hear me roar. Yeah.
And the only one who can save this city is a creature of the night.
On the UK music scene, perennial indie also-rans Pulp are having another try at success with another new single, OU Gone Gone. Having formed in Sheffield in 1978, they'd released two albums up until this point, It in 1983 and Freaks in 1987, neither gaining mainstream success despite some critical acclaim, including from Radio 1's great champion of The Outsider, John Peel. In mid-1989, they began recording a new album, Separations. The release was delayed significantly, to the point that by 1991, they ended up leaving their label Fire to sign with Gift Records and release a new single, Oh You Gone Gone, in June of 1992. With Separations, Pulp had split the sound between the first half, which focused more on Jarvis's obsessions with the French chanson stylings of Serge Gainsbourg, Jacques Brel and Scott Walker, with the second half going into a more experimental acid house sound. Oh You Gone Gone manages to combine these two styles with a classic chanson-style song of a woman leaving after a breakup, with the verse ramping up with a Brel-esque ascending melody as the plot thickens, while Nick Banks' house beat drives everything along at 100 miles an hour, with Candida Doyle's synths giving everything that kitsch, geek-chic feel that would later endear Pulp to the nation.
The night was ending, he needed her undressed. He said he loved her, she tried to look impressed. After the breakup, it's just something you do to stop the night time from falling down on you. The world is ending, the sky's falling down. She's at the station, because she's leaving town. Or you can stop her, if you get out of bed. She wants to see you, at least that's what she said. You got a minute, at the very most. And she could go.
Chorus hits, it's catchy as hell. Jarvis repeating, oh yeah, she's going away, plus laying in some fantastic vocalizations that he would later revisit throughout his career. Unfortunately and unsurprisingly failed to chart, but Pulp had laid down a marker, and as Gift then teamed with Island, their next run of singles and the following album His and Hers would push them into the mainstream, and we all know what happened next. Meanwhile, in the charts, the band at number one throughout June 1992 featured Andy Bell. Unfortunately, it wasn't Andy Bell from Ride, but Andy Bell from Erasure, with their ABBA-esque EP, which featured covers of four ABBA songs. The ABBA Gold compilation would be released later that year and go on to be one of the biggest selling albums of all time. Some 80s bands were still riding high, with The Cure's Friday I'm In Love peaking at number 6. At the other end of the charts, The Pogues without Shane McGowan reached 56, with a cover of The Rolling Stones' Honky Tonk Women. Meanwhile, U2 were experimenting with the modern dance sound with their single Even Better Than The Real Thing. The original mix was released in June, reaching number 12, but then a month later the Perfecto mix came out and did a little better, making number 8.
Well, it's always been, my hair is somewhere.
Manic Street Preachers released their fifth single from their debut album Generation Terrorists. Now, typically, by the time you get to a fifth single, you're scraping the barrel. Yet the Manics, with Motorcycle Emptiness, had released an iconic record of skyscraping ambition, showing there was far more to them than just iconoclastic sloganeering. The remarkable lyrics attack the futility of consumerist society, which James Dean Bradfield perfectly delivers through both his magnificent vocal and majestic guitar work. Having had a hit with The Life of Riley in May, the Lightning Seeds were back with another pop classic, Sense, featuring a searing harmonica solo by Mark Feltham, who would later go on to play on a number of Oasis records. A number of other early 90s bands that never really broke through to the Britpop years also made the charts, with Carter USM having a hit with Do Re Mi So Far So Good, and The Farm doing the same with Rising Sun. The success of grunge music, and particularly Nirvana, was demonstrated by the fact that Weird Al Yankovic achieved his biggest chart success for years with his parody of Smells Like Teen Spirit, Smells Like Nirvana. And finally, in Wigan, The Verve, or as they were known at the time, Verve, released their second single and their first to make the chart, She's a Superstar. The CD version came in at a whopping 8 minutes 56 seconds. The vinyl was a more palatable but still not particularly radio-friendly 5 minutes. The song is very much in the psychedelic shoegaze style that was very big in 1992, giving plenty of space for Nick McCabe's guitar work to breathe, before later on Richard Ashcroft's singer-songwriter stylings would take precedence in the band. Anyway, thank you for listening to episode 3 of Britpop History. Join us next time to look back at July 1992, where Oxford teenagers The Jennifers released their first and only single, Just Got Back Today. I wonder what happens to them. See you next time. Hello and welcome back to Britpop History, the podcast where we are reliving the Britpop years in real time, exactly 30 years later. Welcome to July 1992. In the news, John Smith is elected as the new leader of the Labour Party.
Andre Agassi and Steffi Graf are crowned men's and women's Wimbledon champions, and Alan Shearer becomes the most expensive British footballer, signing from Southampton for Blackburn Rovers for £3.6 million. Riding high at the UK box office is the Saturday Night Live spin-off Wayne's World, starring Mike Myers and Dana Carvey.
They're kooky and they're creepy. Save the confessionally. The Addams Family.
All right, party on, Wayne.
Party on, Garth. Okay, I bet you're expecting to see the Addams Family.
Fished in.
Okay, we just wanted to let you know that we're making a movie too.
And it's called...
All right, excellent promo, Wayne.
Yes, artistic yet accessible to a wide audience.
Right. Hey, do you think we'll win an Academy Award?
Oh, I'm sure we will. Not.
Today we're doing something a little bit different, as while we will still look at what was making the charts in July, we are looking at a specific city, in this case, Oxford. And that's because this month saw the release of the first and only single by The Jennifers, Just Got Back Today. The Jennifers were Gaz Coombs, Danny Goffey, Nick Goffey and Andy Davis. Having taken the Oxford scene by storm, playing in pubs they were too young to drink in, they were signed to Nude Records and recorded and released the single Just Got Back Today. The big Oxford band at the time was Ride, and their influence is very clear to hear, from the dreamy vocals to the ethereal guitars. The Jennifers would record a second single, however, following disputes with Nude, this wouldn't get a release, other than on a compilation. They split not long after, with bassist Andy going to university. Gaz started working at a local harvester, where he met Mick Quinn. They bonded over their shared love of music, and would go on to form Supergrass, with Danny, in 1993. Looking at what else was going on in Oxford around this time, Swerve Driver had recently released their fifth EP, Never Lose That Feeling, on Creation Records. They'd formed from a previous band called Shake Appeal that had success on the Oxford scene in the 1980s, with their heavy Stooges-inspired riffs being very out of place with the more twee-pop sound that was dominating at the time through the likes of Tallulah Gosh and Here Comes Everybody. Four members of the Candy Skins grew up in the Oxfordshire village of Islip, and had recorded in various bands under different aliases throughout the 1980s. By 1989, they changed their name to the Candy Skins and were snapped up by Geffen Records, who had high hopes for them and pushed them to tour America in support of their debut album, The Space I'm In 1991. Unfortunately, around the same time, Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit and subsequent album Nevermind was released on the same label, effectively changing the music industry overnight, with the interest in British bands waning, with the focus being much more on other bands with a similar sound and aesthetic as Nirvana. It would not be the last time that the Candy Skins would suffer from bad luck due to awful timing.
There's something happening in here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there. I'm telling you. Beware. I think it's time we stop, children, watch that sound. Everybody look what's going down.
Another Oxford band looking for success in America was Radiohead. The members met at Abingdon School and formed under the name On a Friday.
They played together throughout their time at school, but it was only after they'd gone off to university and come back that things would start to happen for them. They signed for EMI and changed their name to Radiohead in 1991, and in 1992 they released their first EP, Drill, which featured three tracks which would go on to be included on their debut album, Pablo Honey. Despite some radio play, they only managed to make number 101 in the UK charts. Later in the year, in September, they'd go on to release debut single Creep. You may have heard of it. As at time of recording, it's nearing 1 billion plays on Spotify. As mentioned earlier, the kings of the Oxford scene in 1992 were undoubtedly Ride. They'd released their second album, Going Blank Again, making the top five in March, after having just scored a top 10 single with Leave Them All Behind. Next month in August, they would play Reading Festival, second on the bill on the Saturday before headliners Public Enemy. Nirvana would famously headline the Sunday. There were numerous other Oxford bands active on the scene at the time, including Heavenly, formed by members of Tallulah Gosh, Sam Williams, who would go on to produce Supergrass and form The Mystics, plus Tara Milton, who was in the process of folding the band 530 and starting back up as The Nubiles. But enough about Oxford, let's head north. In Blackpool in July 1992, Oasis made their first TV performance at an event called the Blackpool Roadshow. Also on the bill that night was Alvin Stardust. While footage of the show has never surfaced, we are aware that they played Take Me. Take me when I'm young and true. Was it me or was it you? Take me when I'm not so strong. Why is it taking me so long? In the charts, supergroup Electronic, featuring Bernard Sumner, Neil Tennant and Johnny Marr, reached number 6 on the UK singles chart with Disappointed. Marr's old bandmate Morrissey was also in the charts with You're the One for Me, Fatty, and the accompanying album Your Arsenal followed at the end of the month. It was also a big month for the big pop stars at the time, with Madonna, Michael Jackson and Prince all scoring big hits. Plus, that name again, Nirvana, were in the charts with the third single from the Nevermind album, Lithium, hitting number 11. Now my candles in our days, 'cause I found God. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, thank you for listening to episode 4 of Britpop History. Join us next time to look back at August 1992, where we'll try and stay cool in the summer by focusing on the super cool acid jazz movement, as Incognito, Galliano and the Brand New Heavies all hit the charts. See you next time. All right, thank you very much for listening to the Oasis podcast. And most of all, thanks go to our patrons. You put your money where your mouth is, and it's greatly, greatly appreciated. You can become a patron at patreon.com/oasispod, which is where we post bonus episodes and various other things. So do head over there and check it out. You can always follow on social media, Oasis Podcast on Twitter and Facebook, Oasis Pod on Instagram. Email me, oasispod@gmail.com. Give us a subscribe on YouTube and obviously follow, like I've said, Oasis Podcast B-Sides for the Britpop History Show. And you can go back and check out the old episodes on there, which is the 1001 Albums episodes I did in 2020. So, yeah, that's it for today. Thank you for listening. Stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.